I love teaching players how to play off the catch. 0.5 basketball, and there's no better way to do that than through games. So really excited to kind of combine your shooting workout, because that is the first, ideally, what we would want to do off every catch, right? Is catch and shoot.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah, so combining those with yours will be really fun.
Cool. So I think it might make – will you tell me, what do you think would make sense as far as order? Like, if we broke this thing, and hopefully – I believe this is serving coaches. If it's not, message us and say, hey, this sucks. Do less of this on the podcast. If we were to break this three-hour session up into a shooting workout, decision-making technique, playing off the catch, and then – a games approach to basketball IQ, understanding spacing, reads, actions, whatever, right? If we were to break it up into three approximately hour-long sections there, what do you think would be the ideal like order of those three things? Shooting, playing off the catch, games-based teaching. What do you think would be ideal for that and why? And I think that would serve coaches.
Yeah, I would start with shooting. Because we always wanted our players to shoot it, drive it, or move it. So we've always talked about the catch as part of the shot. So just starting to build players from the ground up, starting with shot prep. And then I think 0.5 and just your general skill development then can be combined, where if we're going to shoot it, drive it, or move it in that order, we're going to develop our shot first. And if we don't have a drive, we're probably attacking a closeout. So now we're working off playing off the catch. And then once you put the ball on the floor, you're either going to finish, you're going to have to stop and or pass. So then we develop our footwork through there. So what do our finishes look like? We teach players different finishes, when to use them and why, and then go into your stops and then go into your different passes that you would make out of that. From there, to me, you really have a pretty well-rounded player, right? Like, we want to teach every player every skill. If we have players that can all shoot it, drive it, or move it, then we're going to be a pretty skilled basketball team.
I think we just named our three-hour player clinic, the shoot it, drive it, move it. I don't know, but like, that is it. I think that's our order too. So we'll do the shot stuff, we'll do your stuff, then we'll do the games approach. And the games approach could be, how do you create advantage or domino catches for teammates when you move it? And so we can talk about how do you create double, triple wide gaps. We can give them a couple of actions and play out of those actions while returning back to catch footwork, you know, decisions off the catch, decisions off the drive. And we can apply those things. I think even more decisions off the drive, we can probably teach through games approach at the end and really, really high energy. You know, if we have approximately 60 athletes there, we'll have plenty of coaches. We have six baskets. We could have full half courts on side baskets. You know, if we have anywhere from 12 to 16 players per side basket over four baskets, we can do a lot of like half court, small sided stuff, whether it's 3-on-3 or 4-on-4, continuous flow competitive games, break them up into four kind of age and stage groups. And I think they'll get a lot of really relevant reps that way. Then we probably use the first two progressions of the shooting and catch decision progressions to kind of massage the age and stage groups, so we get to like really dialed in competitive groups by the last hour. I'm excited for this now. Let's go.
Yeah, I really like this, because as we're talking through this, it's obviously going to serve the players, but it's going to serve the coaches too, because a question that I get, and I know that you have gotten a lot, is how do we get our players to play off the catch better? How do we get them to move the ball quicker? So it's gonna serve kind of two in one there with the players, and then the coaches second.
Yeah, absolutely. So every one of you that is considering coming to Final Four, any of the coaches that do choose to get involved with our workshop or the player clinic, we're gonna have observing coaches at the player clinic as well. And hopefully we can put that out far and wide to the thousands of coaches, thousands of coaches are going to come in to watch this thing, to the thousands of coaches that are going to come in to watch this thing, that they actually come to observe both. Mark, what do you think of this idea? We haven't talked about this yet. What if the workshop was directly related to the player clinic, and prepared the coaches for, okay, here's how you can develop players in your offseason to shoot it, drive it, and move it.
I love it.
And so we're going to get a little bit more of the teaching methodology and the thought process. You're going to see this in action tomorrow, but here's the why behind it. Here's how we approach it. Right. And I'll do like a shoot, like a how to teach shooters how to shoot section. You'll do, you know, decisions off the catch session. And then maybe we could popcorn a games-based approach to teaching spacing, drive reads, rim reads, all that stuff.
Yeah, I love the idea because no matter what system you run or, you know, what level that you're coaching, you're always going to want players that can shoot it, drive it, and move it and make great decisions off the bounce. So that's great. I think it serves everybody.
Yeah. Okay. That's going to be awesome. Okay. So those are the two things that are happening. Hit us up. We want to know if you're coming and we will be probably starting in a couple of weeks. We'll have to be promoting both the coach workshop and the player clinic and collecting registrations for that. And I hope we get so many coaches that want to come to the workshop. We got to get a bigger conference room. I think the one I have right now is 40, but it's one of those ones with collapsible walls where you can like double it. So I hope we're in that situation.
Let's take some walls down.
Take some walls down. And I'll start collecting some clips to go along with my presentation as well. So, okay, I'm excited about that. All right, third quick announcement for the Final Four specifically. We haven't decided what day this is going to be on, but I'm going to suggest Sunday. I just decided. Sunday afternoon, we're having a coaches-only pickleball tournament at a venue called the Pickle Mall, which has 16 courts. My buddy's a pro pickleball player, an ex-basketball guy, and at least five of my college coaching friends are avid pickleball players. And so we're going to put it out as a, just another event that any college coach, assistant or head that really likes pickleball can come and play in this this pickleball tournament to be hosted by Pickleball. It's going to be a ton of fun. We will probably charge like $20 per coach so we can give cash prizes. It'll be good. And I've also, we have a feeler out. I'm one, if any of you are directly connected to Mark Few at Gonzaga, let me know. I'm one, I don't know what the word is, one person away. And apparently he is a really good, addicted pickleball player. And we have a friend here local who's another pro that played tennis at Gonzaga, loves Gonzaga basketball. Mark Few is his hero. So we're trying to get Mark Few to come play in our pickleball tournament so that we can surprise, his name's Cooper, so we can surprise Cooper. If Mark Few shows up, he's just going to go bonkers. So if you know anyone that knows Mark Few, hit us up to try to get him to our pickleball tournament.
Yeah, I had him on speed dial, but I got a new phone recently.
Right, yeah.
he might rather be playing in the Final Four, but if he's not in the Final Four, maybe he can come to the pickleball tournament.
But well, okay, you probably watch more college basketball than me. This is a hot topic. I really dislike watching college basketball. So we can argue about that here in a moment. Is Gonzaga have a chance to be in the Final Four this year?
I watched them play against Kentucky the other day. It might have been last week. Yeah, I think they always have a chance. I'll give them that. I don't think they're as good as they've been in recent years, but yeah, they're in the mix.
Okay. Well, then I'm going to invite them and bet that they fail. All right. What do you enjoy more watching? Do you enjoy watching college or NBA more?
Great question. I like watching, I have more allegiance to college teams. I love watching SEC basketball because I'm in SEC country, but I like watching teams and coaches in general more for the nostalgia, the connection to the universities, the rivalries.
Yeah.
But I would rather watch professional basketball for basketball, if that makes sense. I think it's the jump between high school and college is huge, and then there's a jump from college to the NBA that is just as big or bigger as far as the way the game is played. And I think that is what's so cool to see in summer league, because I love watching NBA summer league because you see the progression of players just put into a system so quickly, and all of a sudden spacing's better. And I know the court's different too, that gives you more spacing, but it's really cool to see how far they can take those college players in such a short amount of time.
So well said, and probably a perspective I have never heard articulated before. Because people get so passionate up in arms. I'm sure that the majority of coaches that are watching this would completely disagree with me. Love college, you know, and like would be like, you idiot. Those overpaid, entitled, lazy SOBs. I can't stand watching them blaze through an 82-game season. Maybe I'll watch the playoffs. And it's okay. So I get all of that. And I also really do understand what you said about, yeah, the nostalgia, the fan loyalty, like the effort, the absolute effort that these college players put out every possession. Absolutely. I just don't find, you know, effort that enjoyable to watch. I find artistry more enjoyable to watch. And, you know, I mean, like if you just want to, and again, I'm going to make some enemies here and I apologize, but like, if I wanted to watch someone bang their head against a brick wall with maximum effort, I would watch college basketball. I would actually rather someone effortlessly paint a mural on the wall. That's my analogy. So go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, when we evaluate possessions, we look at four areas: spacing, ball movement, player movement, and then expert use or this timing of actions that you run. And if you compare college basketball to NBA basketball in all four of those categories, there is no comparison. So I think that is probably why we enjoy watching the artistry of the NBA or just professional basketball in general more so than college. I feel like the NBA adapts so much faster than what college basketball has. And you've been a college coach, I've been a college coach, and now more than ever, they are tasked with so many more things with NIL, transfer portal. You honestly don't have a ton of time to do basketball things. That's kind of what you do with your leftover time, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of the hand they're dealt, you know, it's a product of the system that they're in.
Absolutely. I mean, you were very recently a college coach. I was not recently a college coach. And I knew very early, I think I was 26 when I retired from college coaching. that's right, I think, 26 or 27. Because, again, I was, you know, down the bench. You were higher on the bench than me. I was down the bench. And so I would say 10% max of my time was coaching basketball. I mean, everything else, like I was knocking on players' dorm rooms, making sure they went to class daily. And I'm like, this is college basketball. I'm like, you know, there's the dream that eventually you're going to be the head coach and you can tell all your assistants go do all the crap stuff. But like, I wasn't even coaching basketball. Like my most enjoyable times were like doing individual player workouts. That was really all I got to coach. You know, I had such a small voice in practice. Actually, no, player workouts were number one. Number two was coaches meetings. I had a voice in coaches meetings, like to set strategy and whatnot. But then in the execution articulation of it to the whole team, very, very small. And I was just like, I'm not even coaching basketball. And so you're right. That was very frustrating to me. And so I just went to where I could coach basketball over and over and over again, which was wonderful, as I got to do that for 14 years and just create curriculum coach basketball. So much more fun. Okay. Anything else you want to say on that? Cause I have a subject change when you're ready.
No, you go.
Okay. Okay, it's kind of related. And I think that this is a goal for all of us as coaches. The greatest players of all time, Kobe Bryant probably most famously or most recently articulated this, was he became great in the NBA when the game slowed down for him. I think that's language now that's common. And so as coaches, our goal is to protect and prepare our athletes and our teams so that the game can slow down for them as well. That doesn't necessarily equal playing slow. And so how do we do that? And I'm going to offer up an idea, and I would love for you to poke holes in it or talk about how we could do it more. I think that the game slowing down for players is actually a product of moving from reaction to prediction. If, you know, like read and react, right? Or want to react to what's happening. No, if you, I would say that's a step, an early step, is to actually be able to react. But if a player or a team is consistently reacting, the game hasn't slowed down, and you're always going to be slower than the actor, right? The actor or the aggressor or the first mover will always have an advantage. That's why good offense always beats good defense, because offense acts and defense tends to react. So even going back to shoot it, drive it, move it, if we're trying to connect all the dots here, if players are shooting as a reaction, they will never shoot as quick or as well as a player that's shooting as a prediction. And a lot of this comes down to where players are looking. A principle that I would say is a savvy principle is a small change in what you see can lead to a large change in what you do. And that's one of the main things that I think Mark and I, what we do, Mark, when we work with coaches, is we try to redirect what coaches are looking for and what they see and how they interpret that data. You know, like I can go and I was out last night. I had two assistant coaches at practice last night. I pulled them aside after the first half of practice. I asked them, what are you seeing, right? And they both saw different things than each other and a very different thing than what I saw. And so I said, okay, those things are happening, but neither of them are keystone principles. They are tertiary outcomes. The keystone thing that's going to make the biggest change is this thing for us. And so a small change in what we saw led to a large change in what we did in the second half of practice. Same thing for players. Like a small change in what you see. If a player only sees the ball and requires all of their mental capacity and focus to receive and catch the basketball, and then they direct their eyes to the defender and react what the defender is doing, they're going to shoot slow. Their footwork's not going to be prepared to shoot. And they might shoot worse because they're doing it as a reaction. Whereas if they're constantly like sneaking a peek and scanning the floor and building what I call chess game vision. Like if you watch Steve Nash play basketball, he didn't dribble with his eyes up. He handled constantly building a map in his brain where he knew where every player was on the floor. He knew the whole chessboard. That's chess game vision. So he was able to predict based on the mental map that he had. He's predicting where the second or third defender is moving based on where the second or third offensive player is moving. And so he's predicting. That's, you know, that's what LeBron does. That's what Luka Doncic does. That's what no one in college does. No one. Which is why when players, and that's what you're talking about with development, in my opinion, it's unbelievable how quickly players can develop when they go from college to the NBA, but they're not acquiring massive shooting skills or ball handling skills in that 6 months. It's a massive change in what they see. The coaching is better. The film breakdown, like it's just 24/7 changing how they see the game. And it's also why point guards in the NBA develop slower on average than most other positions, because there's so much more new things they have to see. Like Keontae George in Utah is a prime example of this. Like unbelievable college point guard, like a baby deer. He's just starting to get here towards the end of the season in pros. So anyway, I talked a long time about that reaction, prediction, game slowing down, shoot it, drive it, move it, poke holes in it. How do we teach it? What are your thoughts?
Yeah. Tons of thoughts. So I'm just going to ramble myself here. I'll probably have a lot to say. First, I love, like, we talk a lot of actor versus reactor. So action is always better than reaction. I always use the analogy of a receiver cornerback, right? Receiver always has the advantage because they know where they're going. Cornerback is more in a reactionary spot. But we can do things to try to level the playing field defensively. So looking at it from a defensive perspective, a cornerback could try to, shade to the inside to force everything to the outside. So now when they're lined up, I know if I'm getting beat, I'm going to be beat to this side, which lock left, right? We're not letting the ball go right. So if the ball is going to be, if the ball is going to crack the shell with the bounce, it's likely going to go to the left, or it should be going to the left. Same thing with like a pressure man-to-man system, that if we are sideline baseline, where we're cutting the floor, where we can try to level that playing field. And then second thing I thought of was point five. I'm glad you mentioned shoot it, drive it, or move it in there, because action always better than reaction. And the term point five came from, hey, you have half a second to make a decision. I would actually argue you should make the decision before. I think what the pros do better than anybody is read closeout before the catch. So they're coupling perception with action. They know, one, offense should be predictable. And I shared this in our community chat in the app this week. I heard it and I loved it, where one, our opponent should know what we're running because we run our stuff and we run it well. But as an offensive player, we should be really predictable, thinking, oh, well, we just created an advantage. We got a kick out. If I go one more, we're getting a three. And we know that that three is happening before the ball even touches their hands. I love what you said about a novice player takes all their energy and all their capacity to just catch the ball. And then it's like, okay, well, now what do I do? I'm coaching my fifth grade daughter's basketball team, and that is exactly what we do, because we are very young and green. How do we get players to make these reads faster? Because that's what's actually happening. The game is not slowing down. They're able to see the game because they now have a trained eye. A couple of different, obviously, perception and action, right? But I think it's our job as coaches, and it goes back to games-based approach. You need more reps at doing that, right? Like, the pros have played more games. They've gotten more reps. So as coaches, especially in a world where players go and do one-on-one workouts all the time, it's our job to play more games in practice so we catch up on all those reps that they're missing, that maybe they were in a drill based system instead of a games based system. Probably have a ton more to say there, but
that's really good. Okay, let's go fifth grade. Let's go youth development real quick. I don't know if you've ever tried this. I've tried it, and actually, like, as a portion of our development, I love it. Youth basketball, no dribbles, no travels, I think is one of the best ways to improve reading and free up mental capacity. So the offense is not allowed to dribble, and there are no travels called. Like, it's unbelievable. Like, as we all know, youth basketball is really hard to score. Like, teams are going to win 15-8 a lot of times.
Yeah.
Right. But like, if you can't lower hoops and have smaller balls in your league, even when you train, I love that as like a rondo or a small game, no dribbles, no travels, all of a sudden scoring skyrockets. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. I love that. I might use that actually. I just moved back to Louisiana, and my daughter kind of rejoined, a club team that she was on. They asked me to coach. And the parents that were coaching were doing a really good job. They just were not familiar with the constraints led approach. So instantly they were like, well, this is everything we wanted our girls to be able to do, but we didn't know how to get them to do it. So I think at the youth level, what you're doing with no travels is you're leveling the playing field, because defense is always going to have the advantage. We just said offense always has the advantage. Not very true in youth basketball, because we're not skilled enough, right? So some things that we would do, we would play one-on-one, but defense had to hold a basketball. And it just, they can't use their hands now. It makes them a little slower, so it levels the playing field. We also love putting offense at an advantage. So no travels puts offense at an advantage, right? Same thing. So more offensive players than defenders is a great way to get them to move the ball. A big turning point for us is when we could understand when I'm open, shoot it; when I'm not open, pass it. So as long as you can use constraints to level those playing fields, the game starts to unlock for them, starts to open up things. Like we're talking about, like, perception, right? They start to see things that they never would have saw. if we just rolled the ball out there and tried to play 5-on-5. One last one that I actually really liked when my daughter was playing like second and third grade basketball. They taped a pack line on the floor and defense could not go outside of the pack line. That way it incentivized spacing for players because they either all want to run to the ball or run to the goal. But if defense can't leave the pack line, if you're outside the pack line, we can move the ball and you're going to touch the ball that way. So I thought that was a pretty good constraint too, to help with youth development.
Yep. Okay. This is good. We're transitioning this. Yeah. I'll have to make a note to Dylan to how to section these things out, because I think we have multiple newsletters out here of a couple suggestions. So youth suggestions. All right. Here's a concept I've been playing with. I would love your feedback on it. Tell me if you like it or not, and why. Zooming out, I'm constantly considering, and for coaches listening, like if you're a youth coach, direct application. If you're a high school coach, direct application. Honestly, like, I mean, we've all seen some of these high school teams play. I would play these games with your high school players at most levels of high school as well. And apply this to your feeder programs and your middle school feeder programs, whatnot. All right, Mark, here's something I'm playing around with. Concept. For youth development, how can we teach concepts like help side defense or help defense without, and this is probably another area where I've made a lot of enemies. I just hate shell drill.
Knew where you were going with that.
Okay. All right. So we can talk about that later. So here's what I'm experimenting with at the youth level and have been for about a year. We play. The principle is I don't teach players to help. I only teach players to switch. And the switch that I'm talking about is like a peel switch, or what we call the lock left to scram. And so we are not allowed to help. We're only ever allowed to have one player on the ball. But any player at any time can run and guard the ball, but they have to tell the on-ball defender to scram. And so I'm actually, we played a ton of scram games. So we progressed from a 2v2 scram game. Offense has an advantage. Defense is recovering. And so the second defender must scram and essentially stop the drive, or stop the nine, or stop the layup. And then we're playing live out of there, which you get dominoes catches and all your good stuff. And then we progress through up into a 3-on-3 game and a 4-on-4 game, where same rule, like no help, only scrams. And scram is a term we use for a peel switch. Here's what I found in teaching that is, it is a core principle of lock left as well. One that isn't emphasized enough by me, I think, in my teaching yet. And also it's one that I think most coaches are a little more reluctant to put in, because it's so different than how most players have been trained. Here's the three benefits that I've seen at the youth level, especially. One, most youth basketball players do not help. If they're in a man-to-man, they are chasing their player around the entire court all the way over to talk to their parents in the bleachers. Like, and they have no idea of helping on cuts or drives or whatever. So like this concept of help defense is so, it's hard to learn. So I think this idea of scramming, which is anytime any teammate is beat, you're switching with them. It's your responsibility to switch. Whose responsibility of the four other players? Yours. It's everyone, right? It's the first person to do it. Doesn't matter where you are on the floor. That's one benefit. Two, when they know they have to scram, it informs where they stand, which is why I hate shell drill, is because shell drill is like, it speaks in absolutes. When ball is here, man is here, you are here. No, there's so many other factors that determine where one should appropriately stand. Who are you? Who are they? Who has the ball? Time, score, all these things, right? Whereas I think the scram allows them to start to actually make decisions instead of just stand at a certain spot. Third, and this actually should be first, as the benefit, it forces communication, which is probably the most important thing on defense. Like when you scram, you have to tell them to scram, and you have to even point where it's going. And so like the cumulative effect of scramming I have found has influenced our communication on defense. Okay. Is it crazy to teach that as your help defense and require that at the youth level? What do you like about it, not like about it?
I like it. And I have never thought about that. So it's something new to me, which I always love. Thoughts that come to mind. We're teaching the inverse, right? Yep. There's always the paradox of basketball. So offense, we're trying to get two on the ball. So we're playing advantage game or we're in dominoes. So defense, we're trying to keep one on the ball. And how do we do that? That'd be the scram or the peel switch. So I love that because you're teaching through principles and you're teaching both sides of the ball. You've got the yin and yang element there. What I also like, and before you even said it, my mind went there, is a question I would probably find myself asking a lot is, all right, Tyler, the ball's over here. Your player is over here. If you were going to scram or peel, how could you make that easier to do that? Well, that would be to adjust your position closer to the ball. And, you know, they say if you can't explain it to a five-year-old, you don't understand it yourself. So the way I would start to explain that is we deny, assuming we're denying, short passes, and we allow long passes. So that might be a way to where you're teaching help position, but not in absolutes, right? Yeah. You're not saying when the ball is here. You're just saying if it's a long pass, that's okay. We're not giving up the short passes. Also, the communication piece, the third piece that you said should be the first, which I agree on, because what coach does not need or want their team to talk better? But what my team was pretty good at peel switching. And I have found being principle-based helps that, right? Like no threes, no layups. Okay, well, if somebody's about to get a layup, yeah, whose job is it to stop that? Like you said, mine, everybody's job, right? And what we started to get really good at is peel switching with no communication, but the communication was nonverbal. And I've always been big on, I always want verbal and visual communication. That way we can hear it, we can alert, we can wake up a teammate, we can help a teammate, but on film, we can also see it as well. So we got pretty good. It's the anticipation piece where the game slows down. It's the same, you know, we're coming full circle here where, all right, we actually had this question in the community chat of, when do we know to peel or to scram, right? You can have a landmark where when the ball breaks the elbow, or you could have a teaching point that you shared I thought was really good, when offense gets their shoulders past the defenders. Mm-hmm. Well, they're beat. I'm in a better position to stop the ball. So I'm going to stop the ball, and that cues the scram or the peel. So I love it because you're teaching help defense, but we're not bringing two to the ball, which is going to help our recovery, which is where teams typically get beat. And not only that, isn't that what we do in a zone anyway?
Yes.
If I'm guarding the ball in the zone, somebody drives, I pass them off to the next player. So we're teaching basketball and not a specific system there.
Yeah. And for our coaches listening, I would, without seeing your team or talking to you, I would argue that this might be the single greatest thing you can add to your defense, whatever defense that you're running, to improve your defense, because most coaches don't do it. Most teams don't see it actively. And it's actually a really simple thing to add to whatever scheme that you're running. If you decided to scram or peel, and I don't call it, I know scram in certain basketball circles is a different type of a switch. It's a backside switch off the ball. I've adopted it for an on ball switch because I want it to be really, really active in if Mark and I are on a team, right? And Mark's beat, I want to tell Mark, scram, go, right? And I found scram or get out of here, go away. It's mine now. Don't stay. Don't get back, right? I want to tell him go away. And so that's why I feel like I like that word better than peel in that scenario, though it is like a peel switch or a run and jump scenario. Okay, I'm going to go further. There's a thing that most coaches or people in basketball said is bad and lazy defense that I actually am teaching every player to do. When you are beat or when the offensive player has their shoulders by you, if we're defaulting to scram, as you scram, as the defender that is beat, I am teaching players to run behind the ball handler. And as they scram out behind the ball handler, to make a play on the ball, to reach around behind and try to tap the ball, up to and encouraging them to hit the ball handling elbow, is the most uncalled foul in basketball. And here's why I love that. And will make and encourage teams to make that bet, even if it does take you a split second longer to scram out to a shooter or an open player or whatever. That's a pick six steal. You get that tip to the defender that's sliding over. It's a direct tip into your teammate's hands. Most other deflections and steals, it's 50-50. It's not direct. This is a direct pass, and you're in position behind the entire defense to go get a nine. Like those steals are golden steals, which I think are different than just regular steals. So I'm teaching, and I can only imagine old school coaches watching me teach our middle school club team to get beat back down. All right, what are your thoughts on that one?
Yeah, another one I haven't heard of. So I love that you're innovating and not surprised that you're pushing the envelope. I like it. It made me think of a couple things. Is one, I think pushback would be, well, I don't want my players to intentionally get beat, right?
Yeah.
So I love this. Rule number one when guarding the ball is do not get beat. Rule number two, pressure the ball to your ability, or pressure the ball as much as you can without violating rule number one. And then what is pressure?
Sorry.
Make them dribble or make them turn their back. So you would still have rule number one, do not get beat, right? We're not playing to get beat. Second thing.
Okay. Well, this is good.
Okay.
And I know that, okay. So we're having a thought experiment here and this is good. So I'm going to, argue a position that I may not actually believe in, but I'm going to argue it if you're okay with that.
Okay.
Why do you not want to get beat?
I would say if you can't guard the ball, you can't guard the rim, you can't guard the three-point line, and it makes it very difficult to rebound. So the ball, guarding the ball would be the head of the snake.
Got it. And getting beat, are we defining getting beat as ball handler gets their shoulders by the first defender?
Yeah, I'll say that.
Okay.
Or, you know, blow by.
Got it. All right. I would make an argument in certain systems against rule number one. I would make an argument against rule number one.
Okay.
I think the most aggressive and volatile version of lock left, rule number one is get beat left. Offense is left.
What about if you're going to get beat?
That would be one notch down on aggression.
Okay.
There is, so interestingly enough, I've had a long conversation. There is, do you know Coach Nick B-Ball Breakdown? Do you follow his stuff at all?
Yeah.
Okay. So he and I have had many conversations.
So he
developed a defense called the chase defense. So he's taken it all the way there, and not lock left chase, but just play behind, chase, get beat, and 100% peel switch all the time. Right? Go ahead.
I could get, so yeah, and that's, that's what I was going to say, is I could get on board with both what you're saying, or the chase, if we were scram or peel switching, right? Because we're going to keep one on the ball. We're being disruptive. We're not allowing them to run offense. And we can all now single task as defenders instead of, well, are they going to pass it? Are they going to drive it? Are they going to shoot it? No, they're going to drive it. Like, we know exactly what they're going to do. So you're talking about the game slowing down, anticipation. Okay, well, Tyler's guarding the ball. The ball handler's about to dribble. What's my next move? Am I the peel or the scram switch? Am I helping the help? Am I sinking to the nail? What is my next move becomes very, very predictable, which means that our high clarity equals high performance. It also reminds me, when I saw the chase defense, and I've heard, you know, we talk about closing off, right? Or it's the same idea, right? You said this really, really clearly. I loved it, and I've said it a lot on my consulting calls lately. Every catch is a drive. Every drive is a pass, right? So if we know we're not allowing catch and shoot, ball's going to be put on the floor. We're all single tasking. I felt like when we were our best defensively, when we were closing people off the line, and I heard this not long ago, and it made me think of my better defensive teams, is it was almost like the offense was running away from us and our close offs, you know? So yeah, I like it. It's very unconventional, and I think coaches probably agree in principle, but maybe slow to do it, right?
That's what I love personally about having a club program, is it's just a lab. And I tell everyone, like, I do not care about winning. Like we'll compete and try to win every game, but systematically, I do not care about winning. Sorry, I got a child screaming in the background there. Okay, so, all right, I like where we're going here. I'm going to go a step further. So you're learning this, I think, about me, Mark. Many of the people have been with Savvy know, like, my goal is to always push the envelope and come up with an idea that might be an original thought. And if there's 10 of them, 9 of them might be too crazy to ever implement. But that one has extreme value because it's zigging where everyone else is zagging. So I'm committed to continuing to speak things that might make me look foolish. And I am excited for you to tell me when I'm looking foolish. Okay. I will go further. Well, first let me go less far and reiterate, all coaches watching, I think that if you can trend towards scrambling, communication, and reading a peel switch when the offensive player's shoulders are by, instead of trying to help and get back, I think your defense will be better. I think that looking for ways to make bets that lead to the thing that we want most, more efficient, effective field goal percentage, higher score offense, that lead to steals and transition scores, I think your team will be better. So we've given you a couple of ideas. Probably level one is, you know, the scram. Level two is when you're scramming, back tap and go, right? Level three would be allow or decide you're going to get beat, but it's just about where we're trying to push the ball, right? If like traditional defense is trying to push the ball away from the rim, because traditionally one of your, you know, most effective areas to score is at the rim. Well, what lock left does is it twists the court, and instead of us trying to push the ball away from the rim, we're trying to push the ball towards jail, towards the left corner, which half the time is towards the rim as well. Half the time it's not. So we twist at the court, right? What I'm suggesting at lock left's most extreme bet is twist the court even further and actually completely invert it and say we're actually pushing the ball towards the rim, because we think that that point of scram is going to provide us a better chance at steals. It's going to provide the offense a better chance at scores, but it's going to provide the defense a better chance at steals. And so that's the suggestion. Okay, here's the last thing I'll say. And then I know we're going over time. This is a great one. I'm really excited about this episode. I hope it's as interesting to everyone else as it is to me.
Same.
Here's my last argument. I would argue that the best way to develop defenders at the youth level would be to require peel switching, require locking left, and require getting beat left as the outcome of locking left. And that you are actually trying, like, and we call our point of attack defender, the one picking up the ball, we call it the wolf. Wolves chase down their prey. That's why we call it the wolf, right? Wolves don't corral their prey. They get on their heels and chase them. And that's what we actually want our wolf to do, is we want to chase the wolf towards jail into our first scram, and to try to get that moment in time over and over and over again. And I would argue that that would make better overall defenders, because every player off the ball would have to be active, communicating, and moving, as opposed to what you see at most youth levels, which is standing up straight, not talking, and not being involved in the play. So I think from a development standpoint, that would be a win for basketball development, because from there, you can play any defense. You can play a zone, or man, or pressure, or whatever, because you're active, anticipating, and moving. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I will echo the importance of peel or scram switching, because that has come up a ton on consulting calls this season. A lot of my opponent shoots a three really, really well. How do you think we can, you know, limit their 3-point attempts? And a lot of it is, well, how well do you peel switch or scram switch? You know, that's come up a ton. It was a game changer for our defensive systems. It's basically what you do in zone defense anyway. The last point about development and development of defenders and making people drive, funneling the ball to the basket being an extreme example. It's probably, although we're the ones, and you in particular, workshopping this idea, it's probably more scary to us because we spend more time developing decision makers offensively. So it's going to increase, it's going to make your offense that much better because you're forcing players to make decisions.
And they're going to get more decision opportunities.
Yeah. So how does the game slow down? You see it more, right? Just like riding a bike. How do you get better at riding the bike? Riding a bike more. And I say that because probably scarier for us because we spend time on decision-making. I'm thinking of the thousands of coaches that don't do enough decision-making. And if you put those teams in these situations, it's actually going to tilt the scale. Yeah, you're going to tilt the scale in your favor. If I rewind to the coach I was 15 years ago where I did very little decision-making, what was most disruptive to my offense, and we were running motion at the time, is when teams did not let us run motion and made us play conceptually. So they're in the passing lanes, pressuring the ball. What do? We put it on the floor and have to make decisions, and we never practice that. And that was our frustration.
Yeah. And so I think that any coach that chooses to play defense like this is actually doing basketball a favor. You're doing your opponent a favor by forcing their players into situations that will actually develop them, even if the coach refuses to develop their own players. That's what I believe about lock left in general. That's why I want every program in the world to run lock left, because you're doing your opponent a favor that their coach is withholding from their players, which is developing their weak end, except for the right-handed players.
I'll say one more thing. Then this is kind of just a one-off to wrap this up. I play pickup every week, and there is a guy with extremely long arms. And the amount of baskets that he saves when he's on my team by back tipping the ball, it's incredible. And when he does it to me, it is the most frustrating thing in the world.
I'm gonna say that is an incredibly valuable defensive skill that should be taught and developed and isn't. you're going to get beat. Every player is going to get beat. So even if you're like, hey, don't get beat is rule number one for your defense. Great. Awesome. But if you do, because it's going to happen, what are you providing or preparing your players to do when they're beat? Which, I mean, we talk about two solutions here. A, scram. B, back tap. And if you're not training those things, I think that you are not getting good at one of the things that happens most in the game of basketball.
Love it.
Well, that was an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, that was fun.
Let's do it again next week.
Yeah, let's do it. And man, I thought I was coming on here to share some things, and I think I did more learning than sharing. So this was double the fun for me.
I apologize, and please continue to cut me off, because I'm verbally processing things that I see in the game. But that's what I want the hours to be for both of us, right? It's like, let's get on and verbally share what we're seeing in the game. Hopefully, so our coaches can spend hours with us and we can continue to grow together.
Sounds good.
Awesome, man. Well, thank you. And everybody, hit us up for if you're coming to the Final Four and want to hang out and spend some more hours with you on or off the pickleball court.
See y'all.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.